there isn't any of this, will they, won't they? And the reader gets to just enjoy their dynamic of banter.
That's just like us, Nick. Everybody's asking, will they, won't they? But no, we won't. So.
Welcome to the Two Authors Podcast, an entertaining chat show hosted by best-selling mystery and thriller authors Douglas Pratt and Nicholas Harvey, in lively, humorous, and informative conversation with distinguished guests who share their thoughts and experience about forging a successful author career.
Welcome to the show, everybody. And our guest this week is Angela Marsons, who will chat with us shortly. But first of all, hi, Doug.
Hi, how are you, sir?
I'm peachy.
Peachy?
Yeah, let's jump into a question from Maureen in Pennsylvania. And Maureen, you're a darling. I know who she is. So thank you for giving us a question. What character was your most difficult to write? You were going to write a scene from a dog's point of view, weren't you, at one time?
Yeah, but I don't think that would have been as hard to write.
It would have been really hard to write. You'd be giggling the whole time like a little schoolgirl every time you tried to write.
It'd be more like, yeah, I don't know. I was going to say if you rewrote from a fart's point of view or something like that. But I don't know. Like the dog, I think I can handle. Honestly, the thing that worries me the most is, you know, especially, and you do this all the time, and I applaud you for it, but is that you see these, there's so many jokes about how men write women. There's an artist who actually like draws the descriptions, and they're hilarious and stupid. And so I am really I want to write some really strong women, but I worry that I'm misrepresenting them. And so, you know, trying to make sure that they don't, you know, like we joked last, you know, with Jeff Carson, I said, you write it, you don't want it to write it sound like, you know, her breasted breastily. So I'm worried about it. I do worry about that. And I've had that talk with some other female writers about how to make sure, and with you about how to make sure you write good, strong female characters without coming across as a man. But I think any character that is a little different than what we are, which is, you know, sarcastic white guys, as Nick Thacker said, it's a challenge to make sure we get in their mindset, to write people of color, and make sure we're not devaluing them or, you know, just disregarding some of the emotions and feelings that they actually have because we don't understand them. That's difficult.
You just riddled me with imposter syndrome as soon as I write all female protagonists.
But you do you do write it. You write it so well. So I'm amazed like how well you do it, and you do it so confidently. And there's lots of great male writers who do write female. I mean, L.T. Ryan, Jeff Carson. I mean, they're writing these great female characters, and I don't think necessarily that I don't. I worry that, and it's anything but females especially, because they tend to be always in the book. I don't always have people of color show up in the book or anything like that, but I do have generally at least one woman in there. So I'll make sure she doesn't come across as just the Bond girl type. So
Yeah. I'd say my answer would be down the same lines. People of color, I think, is probably me, because I have people of color in every AJ and Nora book because they're in the Cayman Islands. And so they're working with or around local folks. And so it's been a big back and forth about, you know, writing accents, yeah, because the Cayman Islands locals have a distinctive accent, and it's it can sound a little Jamaican, but it's not. Like it would be like England and Australia, and if they're standing next to each other both speaking, it's like, don't make a joke, Doug, hold yourself back. They do not sound the same unless you're American, of course, and then everything sounds the same, but they do not. Like if anybody heard the two accents next to each other, they'd go, oh, well, they're really different. And Jamaican to Caymanian is quite different. But it was a big question as to whether I kind of write in the accent or not. And I do it to a varying degree, depending on the character. And I mentioned in every book that a lot of the locals will tailor their accent to who they're talking to, because they know if they're in the whole dialect of a Caymanian, when they hear them talking to each other, it's like they're talking English, but it's got such a dialect, you're like, I have no idea what they're saying. So then the characters, do you write in that accent or not? And I do. And my reasoning behind it, you know, some people may say, oh, you know, it's racist to do that. Really? So if I was writing a Scotsman and I write in a Scottish accent, so that's racist too, is it? So that's kind of where I come from. It's like, this is the way the locals speak, and it's a beautiful sing-song accent. It's delightful to listen to, and it's part of their culture, and the same as the way I'd write an Irish and Australian.
Well, it's just writing the dialect, which I think is important. I mean, I have a character in my book that I comment all the time about, is Mississippi drawl, and I'll, you know, and just drag out the words, you know. So I'll try to write that into there as well. I don't think there's anything racist, but again, I mean, that's just my opinion about it. I think that that's the way they speak, and you're trying to get that across, that this is different. And I guess in some cases, in some accents, it's easier to write without it coming across. So I have a lot of Latinos in my books, and so I have flip-flop between, you know, actually putting Spanish in there or just he said in Spanish so that it doesn't come across too much. But, you know, you do kind of slide a little bit of that in there, and it's authentic, which is important. But you want to make sure you take into account these are people too and not just stereotypes, as long as you're looking at it from that standpoint.
So I think that's the most difficult. Good question. Thanks, Maureen. All right, this week's guest, Wall Street Journal and USA Today best-selling crime fiction author Angela Marson, who's a lovely lady, and book 20 in her D.I. Kim Stone series comes out May 30th, so that's coming up in May. Her book one, Silent Scream, has over 50,000 reviews on Amazon, and it's a wide book. It's not Amazon exclusive, and she has over 50,000, so she's big time. I'm nervous. She's big time. She's somebody. She's not like you and me. She actually is somebody.
I am somebody. I'm in the phone book.
You are, my little buddy. You are somebody. All right, let's get to our interview with Angela. Angela Marsons, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm glad you could. And it's great timing because book 20 in your wonderful series came out yesterday on pre-order and went straight to number one in the UK Kindle charts. That is phenomenal. Congratulations.
That is awesome. Congratulations. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an absolute amazing experience when it happens. I never expect it. I must have some absolutely fantastic readers. And they're just waiting and ready and loyal, and they just want to continue the journey with Kim Stone. So I do keep expecting them to get bored, but it's not happening yet. So I'll keep writing them while people want to keep reading them.
Brilliant. Well, yeah, obviously doing it right. So give us a quick background on how you got into writing, and when did you start?
I always loved to write as a child. English was pretty much the only thing I was any good at. Forget sports, forget geography. I wasn't interested. I just wanted to put words together. And my English teacher said, oh, you're actually quite good at it. And it was the first time I'd been told I was good at anything. So I thought, oh, I'll seize upon this and, you know, see if I can, you know, put a few words together. And I used to just spend a lot of time recording my thoughts for years. I'd make up situations and, you know, then write about how I felt about them. I would pretend that my dad had left us, and then I'd pour my heart out onto the page. I'd be crying, and he'd only gone to the pub. you know, it wasn't far, but I got pages and pages of my feelings and everything. And, you know, I once told my brother he was adopted just because I wanted to see how he reacted, and then I could write it down. And, you know, so wow, I love to make these situations that I could then explore the emotion behind it. And
sounds a little bit like you got a little sadistic feeling going on too with your with your family.
Well, you know, I think you've got to explore all angles.
That's fair,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, the fun was over. The fun, he went and asked me mom, and she explained to him that he wasn't, and, you know, that was all over. But it was a bit of fun while it lasted. so yeah, I always used to write. When I was in my early 20s, I started sending off short stories, and I never got anything accepted. And then I wanted to write something bigger, so I started writing novels, sent those off for years, well, decades, really. Then I turned to crime. It's always been my favourite genre.
You turned to writing crime, not to actually doing crime, right?
Well, if you want to be specific, but you know, I'm not gonna.
Well, I mean, you were toying with, like, you know, you're toying with your brother. You're like, I'd like to learn a little bit about crime. So let's.
Hey, it's called research.
Turn to crime.
You can write it off on your taxes when you're performing crime for research.
Exactly. We'll move on from that question. You know, because I don't want to incriminate myself. So yeah, I didn't think I could write a crime book because I just kept thinking about all the plotting and all the timing and all of this, and I thought I can't ever write one. And Silent Scream kind of became my rebellion book. It was like, okay, I'm going to stop writing books that I think editors and agents will love. I'm going to write the book I want to. I'm going to base my main character, who's been in my head for years, I'm going to put her in the Black Country and I'm going to give her a murder to solve. And I totally expected to hit a wall at about 40,000 words. And at least then I'd have been, well, I gave it a try. You know, I failed, but at least I tried. But it was at that point that the pencil just seemed to run away with me, and I couldn't write the words quick enough. And before I knew it, I had 90,000 words, and it was like, how did that happen?
Can I ask you a question then? Do you plot it out, or do you pants it? Like, it sounds like you were pantsing that one, but are you a plotter or a pantser?
I haven't changed at all. I start off with a subject that I want to explore, you know, that I've researched and that interests me. So I've done cults, child prodigies, I've done human trafficking, I've done, you know, it's always been something that I've wanted to learn more about and then explore in a storyline. So I do the research and then I have sort of like a vague idea of where I want to go. And then I make a start. Oftentimes I'll start and I don't even know who the killer is, but I've got a clear vision of how I want it to start. And then the joy for me in writing is the organic growth of the story, that as I'm writing a chapter, I'll suddenly think, oh, I know what this character can do, or oh, I know how I can move this interline now, and how I can bring this person in or have an expert that does this. And that's the joy for me, is that things happening organically as I'm writing. That makes my day. So if I plan too much, I'm kind of bored already, because if I know everything that's going to happen, it feels like I'm doing lines at school as a punishment. I feel like I'm just writing lines as opposed to allowing a story to just come out. So no, I haven't changed it at all. I still totally fly by the seat of my pants, and there's an element of relief when I get to the end of a book and think, hey, it worked. I'm not there.
It is. It's kind of nice like that. Like, that's, I feel the same way. Like, I feel like, because I write the book, and once I've finished the book and I hit the end, I know how it ends and I don't care anymore. So like, I would just assume if I didn't, I'm done. I don't need it. Yeah, let somebody else deal with it from there. So I don't even want to reread it. I don't, when I get around to having to listen to my audiobook, and I'm like, I already know how it's going. So I'm not interested anymore. I'm ready to write the next one.
I actually had a message today from somebody who is reading the books for the sixth time. And I sent her a message. Yeah, I sent her a message saying, I've had people who've read them once, I've had people who've read them two, maybe three times, but six times. I said, even I haven't read them six times.
Exactly. Including all the read-throughs for the editing. I haven't read any of my books six times. Not one of them.
Uh-uh. Nope. No, that's crazy. Yeah. But we love those fans. Those people that do that are awesome. I mean, they can read all of our books that many times, I'm sure. So
I've got a million questions here from everything you've just said, but let's start here. So you're writing about crime, and your protagonist is an investigator. So have you built over the years a network of people that you can talk to make sure you're getting authentic? Do you have a connection in the police force, someone you can talk to?
She got arrested. Kind of, we heard that. She turned well, crime.
Maybe it's that guy, yeah.
Joining you from prison.
So she's not very good at it, is what we heard.
Yeah, that's why we don't do video.
I've had a couple of people contact me and say, you know, if you ever do want any advice, but I've got a copy of the PACE regulations for the police and that kind of thing. And the internet is a massively valuable tool. But also I try and keep some of the sort of like procedural stuff out of it, because you've got to kind of play into what the reader's expecting you to write. The paperwork now in the police force is unbelievable. Nobody's going to be entertained by me writing about this form or that form or that form. It may be factually correct, but it's not going to make for a very exciting
very
read.
Boring, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, you know, I tend not to... If I know I'm doing something that's going against procedure, then I have a character note that it's going against procedure, you know, so I sort of like get myself out of trouble that way. But I try not to get too caught up in the small detail, because I think there is a lot of small detail now in working for the police. There's a lot of form filling. There's a lot of protocols and procedures. And I kind of use those if it suits the story, if it adds something to the story. But if not, I kind of keep away and give the reader what they're expecting, that there's an interview room, there's a tape machine, there may be a video camera, you know, and keep it at that kind of level of detail.
That's interesting. I just wrote a project in January, which involved police procedural stuff. And I actually reached out to California at the moment, and I reached out to a local police branch. And it took a bit, but I ended up with a Zoom call with their investigator for the Orange County Sheriff's Department. And it was fascinating to chat with him. And the biggest thing that you cannot do in a book or in a movie is the timing. The amount of time it takes for them to get like forensic results back, blood tests, things like that, is ridiculous. There's some stuff they don't expect it for 6 months. And, you know, you can't put that in a book like, you know, Kim Stone. Well, she went on holiday for a while and then she did some other cases. And then this popped up and she got back on the case again.
We have to have a little literary license in there.
Absolutely. Yeah, and they were when I was chatting with them, I'm like, yeah, you understand. We just can't do that. They go, nope, we see it and everything. It's understandable. So,
yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, you'd see that on anything. Like, yeah, it's amazing. You watch even the most procedural like Law and Order and they get all the results back in 15 minutes.
I was a huge fan of NCIS, and, you know, that was a similar thing. And it's like, you know, Abby, I think her name was in the lab, and, you know, she'd have the results like in 20 seconds. And I forgave it because it was such a brilliant program. And I loved it so much. But you just thought, that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen.
No, none of that happens. So with 20 books that you have coming out, like how far out are you projecting your character arcs for, you know, Kim Stone, like, you know, when you started thinking about back at book three, like where she was going to be, and, you know, are you thinking that far ahead? Like, I got arcs in books, you know, from one to the next, or just like maybe arcs in 3 to 4 books of each storyline?
When the voice was first in my head, she didn't sound all that pleasant.
That's what Nick says about me all the time.
So she stayed in there for such a long time. So I thought, well, if I don't like her, the readers aren't going to like her. And that was why I said when Silent Scream was my rebellion book, it was like, okay, this character's coming out. And it was when I let her out that I got to know her better and realised that, yes, she is rude, she is brusque, and her social skills are non-existent.
Wow, that's exactly what Nick says about me.
But her passion and, you know, for justice and for fighting for the underdog outweigh that. And I knew that not everybody was going to like her. And I knew that some people would start Silent Scream. They would say, do you know what? I don't like this main character. And that was okay. I accepted that. And it was like, but I've got to stay true to how the character is now on the page. Although each book, she doesn't seem to have a lot of progression, it's like for her, it's major progression because, you know, if she can even, you know, be pleasant to a stranger or say thank you in given situations or say good morning or, you know, that kind of thing, that's a huge progression for her.
Oh, and that's realistic too.
I think those kind of characters are great. As long as the key is you're having huge success with this series, so you've got it right. Yeah. And you, no one gets beyond book one if you don't get it right in there. So there has to be something captivating about that character. And I'm big on this. If I watch a TV show and I don't give a shit about anybody that's on the show, especially the main characters, I'm turning it off. If I don't care what happens to any one of them. So there's something about her character, and maybe it is part of her abruptness and awkwardness, you know, like Bones on the on that TV show. She's all kinds of awkward and stuff. It's that's what's appealing, right?
Do you balance that out though with other characters?
Yeah, I do. I always knew at the beginning that I didn't want any of the will they, won't they sexual dynamic. So I deliberately partnered her with a happily married man. He's pretty much her only friend. And when we start the series, she has no friends. She cannot get on with anybody. And there is literally only her partner that she classes almost kind of as a friend. She's had to grow into that. And he can get away with murder with her more than anybody else. But it is a purely platonic relationship. And that is made clear from the outset, so that there isn't any of this will they, won't they. And the reader gets to just enjoy their dynamic of banter. She insults him. He insults her. They have a laugh at each other's expense, you know.
That's just like us, Nick. Everybody's asking, will they, won't they? But no, we won't. So.
I think it's a brilliant rule of cutting that out of it too, especially if, you know, when you're on book one, you don't know you're going to do 20 books, right? You're going to do some more, but you don't know you're going to do 20. But at some point with that will they, won't they thing, they have to go one way or the other. And whenever that happens, it breaks the series. It's a moment. Like if you watch TV series and all that kind of thing, when they finally get together, all of a sudden the whole series changes.
People say to me, oh, when is she going to find love? And I'm like, she's not, because that would be, you know, that would be the end of the series for me, because she has attractions. There is no definition of her sexual preference or anything like that. She has attractions. However, it is no part of the story, because I want to read a crime book without romance. Her other characters, the rest of her team, you know, the younger members, they can have romance, but not Kim. Because like I say, if I start writing that, the stories completely change for me. She needs to be a nomad. She needs to be out there on her own. And that's the voice that's in my head. So whether or not I lose readers, you know, because they wanted to have a romance, unfortunately, that's not going to happen, and I'm quite upfront about that.
Hey, Angela, newsflash. You're number one in the UK on a pre-order.
I don't, yeah, they're not don't running care. For the doors. They're like, yeah. they're happy with that. That's
they're
awesome.
Not running yeah. for the doors. I love the fact that you have your character so well-defined in your head. It's easy to get lost over time and influences and everything else, especially as, you know, that's a long period of time you've been writing that. Personally, in your own life, I'm sure you've gone through all kinds of things over those years, and they affect us as a writer, correct? So the fact that you've got this solid definition of your main character and you're true to her all the way through, I think is absolutely brilliant.
One of the things the readers say, sorry to interrupt, is that when they pick up a Kim Stone book, it feels like they're meeting up with family again, because they know the characters so well. And I try to explain, that's actually how I feel. When I pick the pencil up and the notepad, I'm actually thinking, okay, what's she been up to while I've been away? And it's very much that same feeling for me, that I'm rejoining the team and literally just documenting whatever they're up to next. So I think that translates to the reader, and that's how they find when they're picking up a new book. But it's exactly how I feel writing a new book.
Okay, I've got to ask this because you've mentioned it several times, the pencil and the paper. Do you write manually still, pencil and paper, or are you using a computer?
I sure do.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love it.
Yeah, so she's holding up a spiral notebook, it looks like. Yeah, so that's awesome. Cheers for our listeners.
Who gets to transcribe that?
My partner, Julie. We have been together for 38 years, and she has been with me every step of the way. I write, Julie types and reads at the same time. We work together totally. She knows the characters as well as I do. So she will say, Stacey wouldn't do that, or, oh, that was a little bit harsh for Kim, or more often, that wasn't harsh enough for Kim.
Yeah.
So she's been, you know, everything, every book we talk about, we have meetings about, we go over, she helps me edit them, and it's a total team effort, and then they go off to the publisher. So, yeah, they're always handwritten, always. I tried to type one once, and I just stared at the computer for hours, and I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Give me a notepad back. I have to feel there's a connection between my brain and the movement of the hand. And if I haven't got that, honestly, it's like somebody's just switched the light off.
Oh, my God. That's brilliant. Shout out to Julie and shout out to the pair of you for 38 years. That's fantastic. And it kind of leads me into my question I was going to ask you, which is, how complete is that first draft? And it sounds like your first draft, between it being written on a piece of paper by you and being transcribed into the computer, there's a massive amount of editing work that goes on in that phase before it ever goes to you with Bookature and before you send it off to those guys. Does that sound accurate?
It does, yeah. I mean, I'll write the first draft, then Julie's typing. By the time I finish the first draft, there's a hefty amount for me to start going through. So we do draft two, I do on the computer, because I'm in business mode then. You know, I always think of the writing part of it as being my sandpit. That's my playground. I can write whatever I want. You know, if I want to bring aliens into chapter 37, I can. Because on draft two, I'm going to have to take them out again. I accept that. But on draft one, I can do what I want. So then draft two is the business side, you know, the more business side. So I'm on the computer, I'm editing, taking away, adding here and there, and then get to the end of that. Then I go through it from start to finish again. So it's been through at least three times by the time it goes off to Bookature for the first read by the publisher.
Right, so how is that relationship with Bookature and your editor? How does that work with you guys? I mean, do you have the same editor every time? And that's something I'm sure some of our listeners who are either first time or new authors are kind of like, you know, trying to figure out how to walk through that maze of things.
I had the first editor for the first eight books, but then she left. Second editor, who'd been also involved in the books, because Bookature was very small when I joined them. It only consisted of three people. So second editor went about four books ago to join another publisher. But every editor I work with is open, transparent. I can ask them anything. I don't have an agent for the books. So everything is one-to-one between me and them. I trust them completely. They're always open and honest. And I can send an email, make a phone call at any time. They're there. Emails are returned within seconds, minutes. They're absolutely fantastic. I've always said they will have to throw me out. They will have to get security to escort me from the building.
Have you ever gotten a suggestion back from them that you're like, ooh, yeah, I don't like that? I mean, and just say, no, I got to keep it the way I want it. Or is it pretty much you go, okay, well, you know, they know what they're talking about in that regards. And I think that's something sometimes we as authors get so connected to our manuscript that when somebody tells us, oh, I think you should change this, that we're like, ah, how dare you? It's like changing my kid's eye color.
I send the book off with always the attitude of, now I'm going to get help in addition to me and Julie to make it the best book it can be. And that's what I send it off with that logic, that I'm not going to be precious. I'm not going to not murder things that need to be murdered. However, I trust my gut. If I read a suggestion and my gut reacts unfavorably straight away, then I know that that's something I need to fight for. If I can straight away see, oh, that makes sense, I can see how that would strengthen the book or the plot line or the character, and I tend to feel it in my gut. But if they're saying, no, this doesn't work, and I feel strongly, we'll go back with, no, I think you're wrong, I want to keep it, and here are my reasons why. So I'll never just go back to them and say, I think you're wrong. and I want to keep it. It will always be, I think it adds this, or I think it does that, or in another book I'm planning on doing this, or, and I will always have reasons and why I want to keep something. But by the same token, I'm more than happy to listen to suggestions. Because I think, I don't know if you're the same, by the time I send it off, I've had enough. I want somebody else.
I'm telling you. That's what I'm saying. Finish that book, I'm done, yeah? Now, let me ask you, though, let's jump back to how you write. Like, writing out by hand, especially, I'm amazed that you do that. That's awesome. But you're putting out 2 books a year, like, roughly, I think. Is that correct? Like, recently, like, one in November, one in May. And so I'm thinking, like, to handwriting, how does that, how, are you super fast at writing? Do you put down a set number of words every day, or you just kind of, I would feel like you'd be a little slower handwriting.
Makes it harder to count words when you're writing it by hand, right? You just sit there and 1, 2, 3, 4. I guess you go by pages of the spiral bound and you get to know a rhythm, right?
It's roughly 150 words a page, so I've always got a rough of where I am. No, I don't have any set time because it all depends on what we call the burn. And you'll know what that is when you're writing and the house could fall down around your ears and you wouldn't even notice because you're that much into what you're writing that nothing else exists. If that's happening, then if it's, we, there's been nights where I felt the burn at 1 o'clock in the morning and we have not gone to bed until 7. There's been nights where we haven't even gone to bed because what there is that burn, I won't stop until my hand physically cannot write anymore because I just want to get down all the thoughts or all of the story that's in my head. So I have nothing set. It's just if it starts slowly, it means there's more late nights or long days the closer I get to, you know, deadline. If I was to go for an ideal, I'd probably go for around 1,500 to 2,000 a day. That's a nice, healthy amount for handwriting. If I do 3 or more, I probably feel it a bit more in the hand the next day. But generally, it's right while the iron's hot, so to speak.
That's great. I'm amazed you can do 2,000 words a day handwriting. I think, you know, most of us, we don't do that anymore. You know, my handwriting used to be pretty good when I was younger. Now it's like crap. It's a bunch of scribble and garbage and all that kind of thing. So, all right. So we've got a question we like to ask everybody. What do you feel your superpower has been over your writing career?
I think it's been tenacity because it was 25 years of rejection. And there were many, many, many times where, you know, I just thought, this is never going to happen. I'm never going to be able to achieve the dream. So just that keep on going. Again, Julie was a massive part of that. She believed in me when, you know, nobody did, not even myself. She would always say, when 20 rejections came back, she was like, their loss. It's their loss. And it will happen.
I was going to say, I think Julie sounds like your superpower. It made me think. I'm like, what's mine? Cheryl. Cheryl's
absolutely
my superpower.
I was going to say, yeah. Ashley's definitely mine.
Yeah, that's
pretty
good.
It's nice to have supportive partners who can keep us running. I mean, that's the whole thing is I think that I know Nick and I both, you know, our spouses have kept us, you know, they're definitely partners in our business. So, and it sounds like the same way with you. And that makes it so much better. I've talked to writers whose spouses never read their work, never look at anything. They're just, you know, and I find that so weird.
All right, we got one more question for you before you're off the hook, Angela. This is the demon question on that we're going to spin the wheel.
We have a wheel of questions, okay? And it's all about the sound effect. So you get the sound. And like Vanna White, we wait slowly. Okay. And my handwriting is atrocious. So you, this is a really good one for what we were just talking about. All right, let's say we talk about people rereading your book. What is a book that you yourself have found that you would reread at any point?
Disclosure by Michael Crichton.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah. That's a really good one. Yes.
And I'll tell you why. It's the first book that ever made me call into work sick because I could not stopped reading it. And so I was up until 6 o'clock in the morning. And so I phoned in sick for work so I could get some sleep. And it was the first book to ever do that to me. And I went back and read it again so that I could understand why it had had that effect on me and what Michael Crichton had done to make it so that I could not physically put that book down. So that would be the book for me.
This has been outstanding. Thank you so much for joining us, Angie. Congratulations on your... That's just a pre-order. Wait till the book actually comes out. And it comes out in May, correct?
It is, yes, it is.
May, yeah. Well, brilliant. Well, it's going to go straight to the top of the charts, and the best of the luck with it. And you've been a delight. Thank you so much for coming on.
No, it's been fun. Thank you so much for asking me.
Oh, thank you so much, Angela Martins. She's an angel.
That was awesome. She was delightful. That was so much fun. Yeah. You bring these Brits in here and they're all so nice. I'm like, wow, why do we even rebel against y'all?
Yes, especially when you look at it these days, right?
Oh, yeah, tell you about
it. That's what I always tell people. Yeah, look what you've done with the country.
That's right. But you know what? She's right. Like talking about how she writes her characters, what she didn't want a love triangle, the would she, will they, won't they whole thing. And really that's, she's right. Cause you think about any series, like I said, what series ever made that work? There's been almost none.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about it at the time because, you know, it's happened in so many and it just changes it so much. We've been watching Suits through Netflix, you know, the series Suits. We never watched it back in the day. And a few friends of ours said, oh, you got to watch this. And we started watching it. We're like, and got addicted to it. So now it's the last show we watch before we get into bed because it's always amusing and it's fun. And, you know, it's completely unrealistic, but it's fun. And they go through all this craziness. But the relationship when Markle's character gets together with, what's his name? I forget his name now. But they have this whole tension for seasons. And then they finally like fall in love and get together. And it's like, it took me like 5 or 6 shows after that to find the equilibrium again. It changed things so much. It was, and it's weird, just mentally, emotionally, it changed things. So, and that's in a tongue-in-cheek, fun show, you know. So if it's something that's more serious and critical.
And I think like your Nora character is just like that. You mean, you said that, but it's, she's a no-nonsense, doesn't take crap off anyone, doesn't care what people think kind of thing. And I think that's kind of great.
Yeah, it's honesty, right?
Well, I think people want that too. People want to be able to say, I mean, like Nora says the things that most people are like, huh, I wish I could say that.
Yeah.
You look there and people like those kind of characters. House was always, that's one of those, I loved the show House and Hugh Laurie was brilliant in it. But his character was just, he was an asshole. And
yeah,
people
complete
want
asshole.
That. People want to, yeah. You know.
There has to be another attribute that they have. I think just being blunt and rude to people is a turnoff. There has to be, they have to be charismatic in some
way. I've been telling you that forever. You need to be more charismatic.
I know, but I can't. I've got all the rudeness and none of the charisma. <That's>
But I do think, that is a, one, it's a true character. Like everybody is not always happy. In fact, most people, there's probably more people who just have that fed up attitude, and you know Nora definitely has that. I love that about Nora. Her series, she's just like whatever, you know. It's like it doesn't matter.
Yeah, and you know, part of her arc is accepting happiness and accepting that she is actually a positive in the world, and she's a positive in some other people's lives. And for me, that losing Summer was a big moment in that. Crossing a point in her life where she recognized that there was a reason for being around and that she is good at doing stuff.
But you balance that. You balance it out. Her partner Jacob is he's always kind of, I always figure he's very resigned. Like I'm just figuring he's like whatever.
which
often feel is what my wife says. Like whatever, just do whatever. What you want. Yeah, but that, yeah. And I think that. That balances it. And then you do slide almost every Nora series. You have AJ show up as just kind of like this, like guiding.
Yeah. This positive light. Right.
But I think that's good because Nora doesn't need to get real positive. Like she can do her arc, but she's still going to have that, just that inner turmoil that's still there,
Yeah, her bluntness and her straight to the point. Yeah, well, I'm writing Relentless Summer now, and it's well, when this comes out, I would have written it, and it'll be coming out later in the month. So, and she's there's plenty of Nora-isms in there. Hope Nora fans will like it. I'm loving doing it. So, all right, this was a great show.
It was great. Well, yeah. Make sure everybody check out our show notes, because we'll have links to Angie's books and her website, as well as social media, and we're here every 2 weeks, so come join us. It's so much fun.
Come give us a listen. We tell the people that are actually listening to it right now, because they're hearing us say that. But
all three of y'all come back next week.
Yeah.
So
yeah. See you in 2 weeks, Mom. All right.
Your mom messaged today and says she got my book, and I love your mom. So she's
a bigger fan of you than she is of me.
Well, of course she is. She's like,
well, I can't blame her.
She's been sending me messages on the side. She's like, I wish I was, you'd have been my
I wish my son could be more like you. On that note, until next time, be cool to each other.
Fair winds and following seas.
You've been listening to the Two Authors Podcast with Nicholas Harvey and Douglas Pratt. Subscribe on your favorite platform for alerts on new shows coming every 2 weeks.